Okay, now this works as well. I'm going to upload a past exam from last year so that you know what's coming. We're going to make minor changes to the format, but they are going to be minor changes. Okay. Last year it was a range of, it was six questions that required a short answer. And there was an essay of something like 100 words. We're going to say 100 to 150 words probably next time. And you have a choice of two topics there. Okay? And you're supposed to write a sort of coherent essay so that we can also judge your language abilities. Okay? Please don't, I'll be saying that again later on, please don't spend time counting the actual words. We had students last year being terribly worried that they only wrote 97 words. Okay. And then sort of, well, I don't need to go on, I think. We're not going to count the words, okay? We have better things to do than counting whether you've, well, anyway. So don't worry about that. It's a range, and if it fits on the page, it'll be fine. Okay. As I said, I will at least provide sample past exam questions, but I think I'm going to upload one of the whole exams so that you know what's coming your way. Okay? That's everything I'm going to say now about the exam, unless there are questions. Okay. There will be some more, but it's a bit early. I've also uploaded, I did that earlier today, the no list for phonetics and phonology, which you'll find on StudIP in the Allgemeine Daten folder, and that should give you an idea of the kind of terms that I would expect you to know in the exam. Okay. Again, it's the same thing. If it's bold, then it's very important. You'll be expected to actively use those central central concepts, and if it's in brackets, then this is something that's, well, if you know it, it's nice, but it's not going to be required. I also like to remind you of the deadline for the first assignment. Some people have handed in theirs already, either here or to my secretary. Please make sure that you do so by the 30th of November. It's online. For those of you who haven't downloaded it yet, you should also all have received an email from me about the fact that some things are missing. Yes, I'm aware of the fact that the encyclopedia is missing. There is a second version of it in the library, but that's not by the same editor, so, anyway, you don't need to answer the question 1B. There are alternative ways of answering question 1A, so I thought I'd leave that in. Okay. May I remind people that Google is pretty good when you want to find out certain things. Okay, it's not the answer to everything, but it's the answer to some things, and in fact, even to some things that are on the assignment. Okay, I had some questions, more or less frantic questions, about what is the MLA. No one knows it. Okay, well, if you type in MLA in Google, then the very first hit will give you a good hint at what it might be. It's not where you actually go and get access, but maybe you can go back to the library with that information and then find out how to get access to the MLA via the library computers. Okay. So much about that. I'd like to do some linguistics with you now, unless there are questions. Yes. Okay, let me look at those things again. I mean, I know, for example, that there is a difference between, the affricates and the fricatives. I'm aware of that. Let me look at that again and make it absolutely clear what's required. I can't answer it offhand.
There are different
Okay, I'll make sure that. Yeah. And if I don't, send me an email. Okay, and then. Okay, good. All right. Any other questions? Good. Let's do some linguistics. The lecture had the subtitle words. So I'd like to first discuss a little bit what the concept of word actually refers to. I also briefly already mentioned this when we were talking about Humpty Dumpty in week one. Okay. I asked you how many words there are in the last line. Okay. And that already pointed to a number of problems involved in the definition. Since we've done phonetics and phonology, we could say a definition of word is a phoneme or phonemes bounded by pauses. Okay. For example, I gave you the word aw, which is basically one phoneme, and, well, it's a word. Okay. I'm in awe of somebody or something. But that doesn't quite seem to work, because what's the difference in pronunciation between an ocean and a notion? Well, okay, but we have a different type of word bound, well, we have a different word involved. So that can't be the answer. Can I ask those people in the background, please, to be a little bit more quiet? So this can't be it. So I'd like to look a little bit more at this, well, in a bit more detail. And I have this rather silly sentence. The cook was a good cook, and as cooks go, she went. Okay. How many words? Yes, okay. Okay, I see some people counting. How many did you get? Yeah?
12,
okay.
It depends.
Right, that is always the best answer. Isn't it? That is always the best answer, yes, okay. I'm not saying 12 is wrong, but I prefer that answer. Why?
Because if you count the different words, it's not 12. Cook is three times there.
Okay, yes, we have one instance of cook that's repeated here, and we've got the plural here. Okay, so let's look at this in a little bit more detail. One way of defining words, in a rather technical way, could be, this is from publication by Jeffrey Leach and colleagues, a string of uninterrupted non-punctuation characters with white space or punctuation at each end. Okay, sort of intuitively makes sense what this is. We've got letters, and if there's a space around it on both sides or punctuation, then it's a word. This is what we could call an orthographic word. It's an orthographic definition of a word. And it seems pretty natural to us. Okay? This seems to be logical. But is this really such a natural division? I have a former colleague in Lancaster has a daughter, and he showed me this little letter that she wrote to them, to him. To Mum and Dad, I like you and I love you, love from Emily. Okay, very cute. But you can see that clearly to her, the division into individual words doesn't seem to come naturally. Okay, and if you think about it, it makes sense, because what the child hears is a continuous flow of sounds. So, although we adults are used to this orthographic word definition because we see it constantly being written, this doesn't seem to be something that's simply natural. I've had 3 haircuts within 5 weeks. I actually have 2 haircuts within 3 hours recently because the first one was so horrible. But anyway, yes. What's the problem here? Well, the orthographic definition is easiest for a computer, okay, but something that we already mentioned when we looked at the last line in the Humpty Dumpty thing. We've got words like I've. Well, is it one word? I have is a contraction of two words. And we've got haircuts, which is, well, we'll call it a compound, but which is, in a way, two words, two separate words, two words that can stand separately, combined. And in fact, in English, we can often spell words like that without hyphen E. Okay. Haircut, probably not, but there are other words, and I'll come to that in a minute. Okay. And then, of course, we can ask the question that you asked, how many different words? And if we ask that, then we notice, for example, that cook occurs twice. This is, of course, an additional element here, but we can say that, we'll go that into that in a minute, but we can say that we have different types, which are sometimes only or mostly only realized once, but in one case, in the case of cook, we have two tokens of the same type. The terms token and type are used in other branches of linguistics as well. For example, when we look at different text types, we, for example, can distinguish, well, we can look at spoken versus written language, and we can look at how many different types there are in a text, and how many of those types are repeated again and again and again. And as I will make clear later in the lecture course, or perhaps even today at the end of the lecture, in spoken language we tend to repeat the same word again and again. We tend to have a much more limited vocabulary when we produce spoken language in spontaneous conversation. Whereas in writing we have much more time to plan, we have much more lexical diversity, and that can then be expressed in the type token ratio, which is sort of the ratio between the number of different types and the number of actual tokens. Okay. I will come back to that later on, and this is also something that you may come back to next term, but I thought I wanted to introduce those two terms very early on. Before we look at this cook versus cooks thing, I would like to come to some kind of semantic definition of word. We could also say a word is a unit of meaning. But does that really make sense? Well, let's have a look at a few examples. If we have the sentence, the plane landed, how many words, as in how many units of meanings do we have? Units of meaning. Well, we could say three. Plane and landed is clear, and the, well, the article has some kind of meaning as well. Okay. So quite clearly, I would be happy with the answer three here. The plane took off. Four orthographic words. We have a phrasal verb, which is, presumably, we could look at it as a unit of meaning. He kicked the bucket. Okay. Most of you will probably know the idiom to kick the bucket. Those of you who don't, kick the bucket means to die. Okay. It has absolutely nothing to do with the literal kicking of buckets. I don't know whether there was originally a connection. I don't know. But in any case, how many units do we have here? Well, two. The person who dies and the actual action of dying. So I think semantics or the meaning of words or the idea of what is a unit of meaning can help to some extent. And in fact, later I will also make the point that even within a word, in a few minutes, we will have different units of meaning. But we also have sometimes cases where more than one orthographic word is a unit of meaning. Okay, let's look at the sentence again, how many words, and that's where I would like to talk about words and lexemes, or rather word forms and lexemes. And that's where the distinction between cook and cooks as, well, different words or not comes in to play. What I've listed here, and now they're all in capital letters, is not really the different word forms anymore, but it's a different, well, if we group all word forms together into the same category, then it's the different instances of those. This is what we call lexemes. So the lexeme is an abstract concept. You don't see a lexeme. Okay? You only see how the lexeme is realized as the word form. And perhaps that rings a bell, because last week I talked about, well, the last 2 weeks I talked about phonemes and phones. And I said phonemes are things that happen in your brain, they're in your mind. You don't hear a phoneme, you only hear the realization of the phoneme as a particular phone. Okay? In the same way, the lexeme is an abstract concept, and the lexeme sort of summarizes or combines all different word forms that can be that can represent or realize a lexeme. Give you another example to make sure that this is what I mean is clear. We can talk about a sentence like this: he walks like a duck, he is walking like a duck, he walked like a duck, or he started to walk like a duck. We have four different word forms of the same verb, of the same dictionary entry in a lay person's sense. Okay. The lexeme here would be walk. We usually take the base form of the verb, if it's a verb, to signify or to as a label, but that's just a convention. And it's also a convention to use capital letters for that. Another way of counting. It's a minor way, but still. Dan read the book. Not Dan, Dean. Dean read the book. Dean has read the book. What's different? Well, it's the same word. It's the same lexeme. And it's even the same word form. But on a different level, well, on a certain level, they are different. Because it has a different grammatical function. Here we have a sort of a participial form involved, while this is not the case in the first one. So we could, if we wanted to, and this is going into a lot of detail, we could even have the concept of grammatical word. So the answer, it depends, really is the best answer, because it really depends on what definition of word that you take as a basis for your counting. Let's have a quick look at how different languages deal with aspects of meaning and aspects of structure of words before we then go and look at the structure of words in English in proper. In English we can say we think. In other languages we would have similar or rather different ways of expressing the same thing. In Spanish, which I don't speak, we don't have two orthographic words. Pensamos. Italian, the same. Well, pensiamo is also one word. In German, we have two words, and in French, two. And what I've highlighted here indicates the same as is expressed by the pronoun we in English. And in the case of German and French, it's actually in a way indicated in both orthographic words that are involved, while in English the pronoun is sufficient to make sure that we know which person we're talking about. So in those cases, we are, particularly in the ones in the first two, we are talking about elements of a word that carry meaning. And that's when we are in the field of morphology. So we're going to look into the structure of words rather than look at words as a whole for the next few minutes. Before I do this, just a few comments on word classes and categorizing words. We know, you know, because you went to school, etc., we know about word classes, we know about verbs, we know about adjectives, etc. And you probably have also heard about that this is the major distinction between open class and closed class words. or content versus grammatical, or lexical versus function. Just very briefly, I sort of assume that this is basic knowledge. We have nouns, lexical verbs, adjectives, and adverbs in the open class, and we've got determiners, prepositions, pronouns, conjunctions, and auxiliary verbs in the closed class verbs. Why open and why closed? Well, the open class word classes tend to be the ones where new additions to the word class are very common. New nouns are constantly added to the language via borrowing or via word formation. New verbs can be borrowed from other languages or can be invented even. We'll talk about invention later on. Okay. But new prepositions, new conjunctions, it's a fairly limited set of items that tends to be very stable, usually over a long period of time. Now, this is the simple way of looking at it. Of course, as almost always in language, it's not as easy as that. These boundaries are fuzzy boundaries, and in fact, there are whole PhDs being written about, let's say, what is an adverb. Okay. And I'll make that point a little bit later on, but also today in the lecture. The primary verbs be, have, and do can in fact be both. They can be auxiliary verbs, they can be helping verbs when they're involved in creating a longer verb group. Okay. I am making, am is an auxiliary verb there, I have made. Okay. But if they stand on their own as a full verb, I am good, then they're considered in a way part of the open class. Okay? We can say more about open versus closed class in terms of meaning. Open class words tend to be more specific. Nouns have a particular specific meaning. Okay? While grammatical words tend to be, well, non-specific. Okay. Open class words tend to be less frequent than closed class words. Many prepositions, many conjunctions are extremely frequent. And as I said before, open class words can change much more quickly than closed class words. Just to problematize this a little bit, what word class does absent belong to? He was absent from the lecture, or from the course, or whatever. What is absent? This is not a difficult question. I'm not trying to trick you here. What is it? Shall we agree on? Yes? You have a few more to go to. shall we agree on adjective? Yeah? Okay? Yeah. But is that actually true always? Can you think of any other word class it could be? This is a very recent change in the language. I'll give it to you here. Can a constable, when authorized by section 7, etc., require a specimen of blood, etc., and then, and absent any medical opinion that for medical reason, etc., this could not be provided. What is this? It's legal language. What word class is this? No. What does it mean? If there is no medical opinion that it cannot be taken, yeah, what is it then? We could replace it perhaps with a different word, but then it doesn't exactly mean the same thing. We can replace it perhaps with without. It's not exactly the same thing, but so what is it?
Come on.
What is without? Maybe I shouldn't have gone over the word classes that quickly. All right. Yes?
Preposition.
Yes, preposition. Exactly. Preposition. Yes. With, of, etc. Okay. But here, absent is used in the slot where we would usually expect the preposition. And it has started not long ago, in legal language, but it's nowadays moving into more general use. I found it in the linguistics textbook once. It's not Finnegan, but in a different one. So it seems to be possible to add new elements to the closed, to a closed word class. But it's fairly unusual, and it usually takes a long time for this to take place. But this is not the same as, it's not the case for open word classes, where a new addition is really quite quickly done. Can we just quickly for a minute stay with prepositions? We all know that with is a preposition. Notwithstanding his reply, he was voted president or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's also a preposition. But maybe you can see that it is a preposition which is actually fused by fusing several words. Okay. In fact, all of you will know the preposition instead of. What do we have here? Traditionally or historically, this is actually instede of. And stede in, 1,000 years ago, meant place. So this is actually literally in place of. Okay. And it's become, through use, fused into something which looks like two orthographic words, but functions like one word. In front of, three words, but functions like one word. And then something like in acknowledgement of, which is a little bit more loose. Okay, it's not as tightly put together as instead of. Okay. So there seems to be some kind of gradient scale. This is clearly a preposition. Is this a preposition? We don't quite know yet. So these categories that I introduced very quickly and that I sort of assume that you all know are not always as clear-cut as they seem, and this is often the case in linguistics, but still they're very good as sort of basic common ground that we can then start from and investigate things in more detail. Okay. But now I really want to move over to morphology proper. Here's a hopeful sentence. The lecture greatly expanded their knowledge. We could talk about the number of words here, but that's not an issue here. What's more at issue is the individual parts of words. And it seems, I think, intuitively obvious that you will understand that great and li are two parts of a word, expand and ed. But the question is what their meanings are, or do they have individual meanings? Great means something, but what is the meaning of li? Does it mean something? Or expand, of course, means something. What is the meaning of ed? Well, the meaning of ed in this case is its past tense, and that's just as much a meaning, it's a different type of meaning, but it's just as much a meaning or a meaningful unit. Knowledge? Is that know and ledge? There is a word ledge, that's not the proper way knowledge is put together. So we would have to say that knowledge is one unit of meaning. Okay. Why do we know this? Because ledge is not a productive suffix. It's not something that can be added onto words to form a new, as I will call it, lexeme. Okay. Here's a definition for you. You're allowed to learn this one by heart because it's simple to do this, I think. A morpheme is the smallest meaningful unit of a language. And basically the second one says the same thing in a different way. It cannot be further divided into elements that carry meaning. Well, yes, if it is the smallest meaningful unit in language, it can't be further divided. So if we have untruthful, what do we have? We have un, we have truth, and we have full. Okay. In fact, you could think about a further division here. Anyone? I mean, can you split it up any further? Well, there's a word true in English, right? What is th then? Yeah, we could say that truth is actually made up of true plus. Okay. Do we have other words like that? We have warmth. Warm and warmth. And we have a few others. Can we form a new word by adding blue, bluth. It's not really a productive process anymore. These words tend to be very old, and this doesn't seem to be something that is common as a productive process anymore in the language today, and that's why we say that truth is nowadays a meaningful unit on its own. That cannot be further divided into other meaningful units. When we look at the elements, we can find different types of elements. We can have a prefix, we have a suffix, and both of them are subsumed under the term affixes, okay, or affix in a way, that's fused to affix, not fused to ridiculous. What do we call truth? There are different words for this: stem, base, root. I don't really mind. Okay, any of those. Here's another word: unloads. Again, we have a prefix, un, and we have something that we attach, namely the s, which is the third person singular marker. Let's look at this in a little bit more detail. We have the prefix. As I said, we have the suffix. And okay, here I've opted for the word root. And I've already told you that the third person singular is expressed by the suffix s. Notice that I've put this into curly brackets here. This expresses the meaning of that element. Now, what does this affix actually do? What does this suffix actually do? Well, it means something, but what does it do to the word? It creates a new word form of the same lexeme. Now, if we talk about suffixes that create new word forms of the same lexeme, then we talk about inflectional morphs. Or inflectional morphemes. I'll talk about morph and morphemes in a minute. What is the meaning of un? Well, it means opposite. It's not loading a car, but it's unloading a car. Is this creating a new word form of the lexeme load? No, it creates a new lexeme to start with. This could be considered as a separate entry in a dictionary. Now, when this happens, when a new lexeme is derived from an old one with the help of an affix, then we are talking about a derivational morph. So that's the difference between inflection and derivation. Inflection creates a new word form of the same lexeme, and derivation creates a new lexeme. Very often in definitions of derivational morphology, you will read, it creates a word that is of a different word class. Yes, that can happen. But it doesn't have to happen. And therefore, it's not a sufficient definition. Okay. Load is a verb, to unload is a verb. But still, we're talking about derivational morphology. What's the root? Well, that's the lexical morph. So we have inflectional morphs, we have derivational morphs, and we have lexical morphs. A little hint, in English, if you see a prefix, it must be a derivational morph. Okay. Now you will have noticed that I said morph, and I think in Finnegan you've read about morphemes. So why do I say morph then? Let's have a look at that in a bit more detail. Notice that we've got something like, well, the ending is eme. We had phones and phonemes. Now we have morphs and morphemes. And I already indicated last week that there is something very similar about this in terms of concept. We also have graphemes, which I think I may have mentioned once, but which I didn't go into. It's the same thing. It's an abstract concept versus a realization of that abstract concept. And I would like to demonstrate this to you in what I hope is a useful way of doing this. Let's look at forming the plural. We have the singular hat. We have the plural hats. Yeah, okay. What's the morph that is used to make the plural? And here is the phonemic transcription. It's, what is it? A voiceless S. Okay. Singular dog, plural dogs. Okay, overdoing it. So we have a different phoneme. It's a voiced S. Ox, oxen, right? So we have a plural morph en, or un, with a schwa. And we could even have something like this, sheep, sheep. What's the morph here? Well, in a way, zero. Now the point is that all of these morphs here, they all mean the same thing. They all mean plural. But they are realized differently. Not necessarily in spelling, we use the S for both, but if you look at it from the point of view of how it is produced, when you listen to it, then there is a difference. Now, this here is the morph, and that one is the morpheme. This one is abstract, this one you don't see. This one you see or hear. So like the phoneme, which you don't really hear either, but which you have in your minds, the morpheme is also something that is only abstract. So what are these then with respect to each other? Well, they're allomorphs. They're allomorphs because they are different realizations of the same morpheme. Remember, phone, phoneme, allophone. Can we just, in the middle of the lecture now, have a quick exercise? This will give you the usual 2-minute breather. Can you indicate all morpheme boundaries here of those words? Tell me whether the morphemes that you identified are lexical, derivational, or inflectional. And can you answer the question whether there are any allomorphs in this sense? I'll give you 2 minutes of that for that. Okay. Let's resume. What I've done here is to color the different morphemes involved. And in fact, what I've done here is, of course, I mean, the lexical is sort of the, it's basically the group for everything that's not derivational or inflectional. We could look at the distinction between grammatical and lexical as well, but let's not complicate things here. I'm interested in you being able to distinguish between inflectional morphology, derivational morphology, and, well, the lexical roots that these elements can be attached to. Okay. So we've got, for example, two morphemes here. This is why the hyphen is not in red. We also have proposal, as in propose, and O. Okay. Again, we could say, well, isn't this further dividable into pro and pose? And people might disagree on that one, because we have impose and other ways. So perhaps this might be useful. The point is that there are very often in linguistics, there are different ways of arguing for or against one particular interpretation. If you take the history into account, then you will be able to split up words to a much larger extent than is the case if you only look at the present day English use. So when you are ever, not in the exam at the end of this course, but when you're ever in a situation that you're not quite sure which of the two possible interpretations it is, well, then say so. It depends on how you look at things, whether you take this into account or that into account. The blue refers to the inflectional morphology, so they're inflectional morphemes, and the green ones are the derivational ones. Did anyone find any allomorphs? Okay. Okay. And then pose would be the... Okay, I mean, as I just said, there might be good reasons to do this, but that's not what I refer to when, what I mean with allomorphs, but, yeah, okay. Sorry, did we? Yeah. Yeah. Does everyone agree? The ED in considered, hunted, and left-handed. Exactly, yes. Now, yes, you're absolutely right. They look alike, and they are all three inflectional morphemes. Okay? But only two of them mean the same thing. Yeah? Now, they look alike, but they don't sound alike. Yeah? Reconsidered versus hunted. Okay? So those are allomorphs of the same morphemes, namely past tense. But in left-handed, we're not talking about the past tense. Obvious now, but yeah. That's obviously also why I chose that sentence, okay, to make that point. Good. Right, that was heavy stuff, now some light fare. Here's another one of my favorite cartoon, Calvin and Hobbes. I'll read this to you. I need help on my homework. What's a pronoun? A noun that lost its amateur status. Maybe I can get a point for originality. It's always bad to explain jokes, but this relies on the wrong interpretation of the derivational prefix pro, okay, which can be a shortening for professional. Okay? So the meaning of pro here is in a way abused. And no, the pronoun is not a professional noun. Okay. Here's one from Wiley's dictionary. Relief, what's the meaning of that? what the trees do in the spring. I'm not going to explain that any further. Now with the next one, it usually takes some people 5 seconds, and then it sort of goes through the lecture theatre, sort of, for the next 30 seconds. Let's see. This is adamant. I'm adamant that this is the case. The first ant. Okay, that was the 10 seconds. Yeah. Okay, a few more people. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So what do we have? We have a derivational prefix, Adam. Adam, which is, well, the first, well, it, who or which, well, who was the first man, okay. And therefore, adamant must be the first ant, okay. Obviously, also not quite true. There are many of those. Okay, if you want to look at the list of those kind of jokes or those kind of creative word processes or where we actually assume wrong morphology, here's a list. Okay. Some are better than others. Okay. For example, here is one which I think is not so good. What's the definition of copulate? It's a policeman who misses an appointment. Exactly, yeah. But why is it not so good? Because it also, I mean, it's a bit of a lame joke, yes, but it also doesn't correspond to the word formation rules that we have in English. There is no, as far as I know, infix you, okay? Which then means, well, I don't know, quite sure what it would mean, okay? Infix, of course, is a term that I haven't mentioned before. We've got prefixes, we've got suffixes, and we also in some languages have infixes and even interfixes. I don't want to go into any detail here. Are there any infixes in English? Some debate about that. There is a tip, there is, you can say something like absolutely, which some people call, well, interpret as being an infix or something like that. There is also one which is, no children around here? No. I once found an example in the British National Corpus whereby someone, someone was recording a person and this person said, "You're not going to record this." "Yes, I am. Non-fucking stop." Okay, it's in the BNC, don't blame me. What is this? Well, it's three words. Okay. But it is actually a unit in a way, non-stop. Okay, and you've got something inserted, which expresses something, all right. But very, very unusual. Okay, now we've dealt with the interior parts of words and their meanings. We looked at inflectional morphology, derivational morphology, and how those sort of create new word forms and new lexemes. How do we make new words is the next question I would like to ask. Well, one way of doing this as a language, or of course as a group of language users, is to borrow a word. Borrowing always strikes me as a really odd word in this context, though, because borrowing is usually something that you take and give back, right? But this is not the case for language, but still. So we've got borrowing as one very common way of adding new words to the vocabulary or to the stock of words that we use in English, for example. And a word like karaoke, or many others, is a good example of that. What we've already seen is derivation. We use a derivational prefix or suffix to create a new lexeme, and therefore we create a new word. And that's a very productive process as well. Happy, unhappy, okay, this is not creating a new word, But if we want to create a new word in the language, then we have the process of derivation available to us. For example, the word, no, not the word, but words with the prefix cyber have become quite popular over the past few decades. We've got cyberpunk, we've got cyberbanking, we've got cybersex, we've got cybersquatter, etc., etc. All of these are words that 100 years ago simply didn't exist. It's also possible to combine affixes. Here is a famous word, anti-disestablishmentarianism, okay, where we have all those affixes combined one after the other. Now in Finnegan, a point is made about hierarchies, which comes first, and there's a little tree in there to show that one was first formed together and then another affix was attached to this. This is something which I personally, in the context of this lecture, find less important. I think it is more important to be able to distinguish between inflection, derivation, and the lexical element. The question of what the process in terms of what comes first is, for me, in this lecture, not important. The next word formation process I'd like to mention is compounding. Very simple, two lexical morphemes that could stand on their own, usually, are combined to form a new word. And you have different options. You can combine two nouns, like skinhead, or you can have nosedive, as in noun and verb, pickpocket, verb and noun, fast food, and some of them are more common than others, but it's quite a productive process involving several word classes. And as I said about less than an hour ago, compounds in English, in particular, can combine two words or can consist of two words that stand separately as orthographic words. This is actually something that I see coming into German as well, possibly as a result of influence from English. So road rage or toll plaza or words like that are, of course, two orthographic words, but really they are one lexical item. The meaning of compounds is quite interesting. And just to give you an example of differences that can occur, we all know what a call girl is. Okay? This is... I'm sorry that there is so much to do with sex today, but there's no connection, it's just... anyway, a prostitute who makes an appointment or makes appointments by telephone. Okay? Call and girl, it's pretty obvious how this could have come about. What's a call boy? These are definitions from the Oxford English Dictionary. Now, as you can see, it is also a young male prostitute, one who makes appointments by telephone. But there are many more word meanings involved that have absolutely nothing to do with sexual connotations. And this is something that you will get back to probably in the next term when we look at language and gender and the fact that certain aspects of language, certain parts of language have, for example, clear sexual connotations, and they tend to be the ones that are related to aspects of female, denotation or whatever. Okay, so a master is something very different from a mistress, for example. But compounds are also different for other are also interesting for other reasons. What is an invisible mending specialist? Well, this is a specialist who mends things that is invisible, or is it a specialist in invisible mending? Okay. Of course, the second. But there isn't really anything in the structure as such of the compound which gives us a hint. And it could be the other way around with other words that are compounded from three different aspects, lexical morphemes. Anyway, just wanted to mention a few interesting aspects there. The next process I'd like to mention is shortening. And shortening is an umbrella term for a number of individual processes. For example, clipping. We can have front clippings, as in phone, telephone. We get rid of the front of the verb. Oh, it's a verb as well. Anyway. Front clipping, as in phone, advertisement or advertisement, depending on where you live, is clipped to ad. And in fact, we can even have front and back clipping at the same time. Flu comes from influenza. Does anyone know what a pram is?
It's a Kinderwagen.
Yes, Kinderwagen. Does anyone know what it is short of? Perambulator, yes. Okay, so there's another... many people don't know that anymore. Acronyms. We've got words like NATO, laser, which are in fact abbreviations, or which are shortenings, which are... the words have been put together on the basis of the first letters of whatever is being abbreviated. And this is actually, I mean, in the case of laser, I always have to think about, and again, I forgot what it means, but it's a sort of light amplified and something. It's actually an abbreviation of something much more complex. They are produced as if they were normal words. So it's not individual initialisms or initial letters that are produced, but it's produced as if it was a single, normal word. Okay. Initialisms are different. ASAP, YMCA, BBC, where we have the individual letters being pronounced. Another, and that's I think the final one, another way of shortening is blends. This is actually a fairly new process. Apparently invented by Carol Lewis, things like smog, infomercial, guesstimate, etc. So we fuse two elements, two individual, potentially free morphemes together to create something like a compound, of course, but it's not a proper compound. All right. Next process. I'm throwing a lot of different word formation processes at you at the moment, as you will have noticed. Conversion. Sometimes called zero derivation, because derivation can change the word class, as you will remember. It doesn't have to. But here what happens is the word class is changed, but there is nothing visible that makes it clear that we are talking about derivation. So, for example, if we have the verb, bottle, we can bottle something up inside yourself. Okay. Or to bridge a gap between two differing views. We can also better somebody or something. Okay. So an adjective is turned into a verb. Dirty, same thing. We could change a verb to call into the noun, a call, guess is the same thing. And this is also something quite productive. Here's another t-shirt for you. Okay. So, Facebook seems to be a verb now. And of course we all know the verb to Google, which is formed from the noun Google. The process that's actually least common, and that's a surprise to some lay people, is invention. It hardly exists at all. Most words are not invented. They are either borrowed or stolen from another language, or they are formed on the basis of word formation processes. And apparently the words nylon, nerd, and blurb, as in the thing on the back of a book saying this is a great book, you must read it, is an invention, or they're all inventions. So as I said, they're rare phenomena. Then we have another process which is usually quite difficult for people to understand. So I hope I'll get this across to you. That's back formation. A typical example given is when we have editor and we create the verb edit. Okay. Notice that I said we have editor and we create the verb edit rather than the other way around. Beggar, beg. Extrapolation, to extrapolate. And then from a historical point of view, P's becomes P, but that's related to Latin. Okay. So what's happening here? The point is that before edit existed in the language, we only had editor. Before beg existed, we only had beggar. But it looked as if it was formed on the basis of a normal word formation process. So people sort of assumed, well, if we have beggar, then we would have beg as well. So it's the deletion of a wrongly identified suffix in a lexeme by analogy with other instances where the suffix and non-suffix forms are both lexemes. Okay. So edit didn't exist before someone or a whole group of people decided, that looks like it was formed from editor, it was formed from edit. Therefore there must be a verb to edit. I think the final process that I'd like to talk about, which is very, very rare or unusual in English or not important at all, is reduplication. Things like helter, skelter are usually or sometimes given as an example, or nitty-gritty. In other languages, this is much more important. Does anyone speak Malay or Indonesian here? Few words if you've been there on holiday. Perhaps you've heard the word hati, hati, hati. Hati means danger. Hati, hati means, as far as I know, watch out. So it's some kind of intensification. Or if you have a word like, I don't know, I think babi means pig. What's one pig? Babi. Babi babi means two or more. Okay. Makes sense. There's more in terms of lexical item. It means more in terms of grammatical meaning as well. It's a plural marker. Okay. So whereas in English we add the plural s, in Indonesian it is done by reduplicating the word. I've already said that some are much more common than others. Some ways of forming new words. Compounding nowadays is the most frequent one. Here are some figures. Every third word is created by compounding, every new today. Derivation, a little bit less common. Conversion, 17%. Shortening, 9%. Blending, quite common considering that it's rather new, and borrowing nowadays apparently only 4%. This was very different in the history of the language. If you know something about the history of English with the Norman conquest, etc., where borrowing was a lot more important as a way of adding new words to the stock of the lexicon. But nowadays apparently borrowing is fairly unusual. There are questions of how to count this, of course, but let's not go into that now. Right, so what I've done so far in the lecture is first to talk about words and the lexicon in a way, or elements of the lexicon, and then have looked at the individual parts of the words, in other words, morphology. I'd now like to end the lecture with a few comments on variation in the lexicon, different types of words, depending on various aspects that are related, for example, to where we use the words, who uses the words, etc. This is, in a way, a little bit of a preview to what you're going to talk about in the next term when you're doing the lecture with Dr. Schaefer. What's a dialect? Well, often people think it means a subordinate variety of English. Okay, bad. Right? Now let's cross this out very quickly. Everybody speaks a dialect. Okay. Some people speak a standard dialect, others don't. Okay. Here's a nice quote that's usually attributed to Max Weinreich, but there are some people think it might have been someone else. A language is a dialect with an army and the navy. Okay. So it's a language is something that is standardized by, for example, let's say the Duden, or the Académie Française, and certain people that seem to uphold certain values to make sure that the good use is defended. Okay. But of course, it also makes sense from a linguistic point of view to look at the different non-standard uses or different regional dialects, in German, but also, of course, more so in English. And it's not only regional dialects, we can also talk about social dialects, of course. And this is something that linguists have done for a very long time. In fact, at some stage, perhaps, it was one of the main things to do in linguistics. And there are there are a lot of resources about this, also when you go to the library. For example, there's something which is the Survey of English Dialects, compiled on the basis of information from people who live in rural areas, and mainly elderly people, who would then speak like someone, presumably, because they were living in rural areas, like someone who had not had much contact with other people and therefore retained the old features of the language. And these, this survey finds some interesting things about individual words for England, like, for example, laying or setting the table. Now, when I asked my students in England whether they lay or set the table, what I did was hands up for those people who lay the table and others who set the table, and it was sort of sometimes half-half, depending on the word. It was very clear that wherever they came from, there might have been differences. And this is quite nicely shown here. People up here lay the table, up here lay the table as well. These people here set the table, and then all those down here lay the table. Okay. Now, these people here apparently fettle the table, but so we can really nicely plot differences in the lexicon depending on regional, in terms of the region involved. When you're about to faint, well, not you because you're not native speakers of English, do you feel dizzy, giddy, or even mazy? Again, it really depends on where you come from. People up here in Lancaster and Lancashire feel mazy, others feel dizzy, and the ones down here feel giddy. Oh, here we have swimy. Okay. Okay. When you sweep the floor, do you use a brush or a broom? Again, that's a question of regional difference. Okay. Those people here brush the broom, and here we're going back to brushing again. Okay. And it may, of course, have something to do with the fact that a lot of speakers here are concentrated in metropolitan London, etc. I don't know. Well, let's not go into detail here. So this is a question of region. But of course, we can also have social dialects, age and gender, or your social class, socioeconomic status. And I'm sure you know that social class is still a very important variable in the British context. This should remind you of the lecture that, of the part of the lecture in the first week, where I asked who uses lovely. And finally, we can talk about register. Regional dialect means our language use says something about where we come from. In terms of a social, when we refer to social dialects, then this is indicative of our social status. Mm-hmm. But register is about what we're doing with language. So this is about uses rather than users, if I have a rhotic accent. So depending on the setting, the purpose, and the participants of a particular speech situation, language might be used differently. I could say thank you by saying cheers, mate. Okay. Or I could say thank you very much indeed. What I'm expressing is exactly the same thing. But it'll depend on who I talk to. If the person in the pub gets thank you very much indeed from me, then maybe this is not quite the right register. So, for example, formal versus informal speech settings or speech situations have a great influence on this. And there is the concept of jargon or specialized terminology that is related to this concept. For example, if you look at HIV positive, that's not positive. But it's positive from the technical point of view that something is there which isn't there with people who are not HIV positive. So this is something which is register specific rather than dependent on social class or on region. A nose drop is something different from rhinoplasty. Well, it's the same thing, but it's a different register. Okay? If you go and improve your nose, the shape of your nose. And that's also where aspects of what people usually call slang, and many people call slang what actually are just social and regional differences. That's not necessarily what's involved. This is a question of register. Slang is a way to identify with your friends, to show that you're part of an in-group, social class, occupation, ethnic group, or, for example, your group of friends. So slang has to do with in-group communication. Okay. You'll hear more of that, I think, next term. Notice that slang is often very short-lived and usually people think badly about it. Okay. Some slang terms last for a very long time, but many disappear very quickly. You can again use computers and corpora to look at what is very common in different registers. We could, for example, look at pop song lyrics, an academic paper, spoken English and written English, and we could look at which words are very common in each register. And you would see some differences. Notice that in pop song lyrics, I is the most frequent one, and in spoken English, I is also a very frequent one. Not surprisingly, in an academic paper, I doesn't turn up among the top 10. And in written English, neither. The seems to be the most common words in all, apart from pop songs. Okay. Now, many of these words are actually closed class words, almost all. Language isn't. Okay. If we just look at the most frequent open class items, then we see some interesting differences. This is very simple. In pop songs, we have love, make, life, boyfriend, baby, no, etc. Okay. And in an academic paper, we have language, speak, writing. This is a linguistics paper, as you can tell, because there is also de Saussure, who's mentioned linguistics, register. This may actually be a paper about linguistic register. So very clearly we see major differences in the use of vocabulary, that's not a surprise, depending on where you use or for what purpose you use language. This is also the case when we look at spoken versus written language. Here's a very nice, well, very nice, here's a description of a rainbow. Normally after very heavy rain or something like that, and you're driving along the road, and far away you see a series of stripes formed like a bow and an arch, and very, very far away, and seven colors. I guess you hardly ever see seven, it's just a series of colors which they seem to be separate, but if you try to look for the separate colors, they always seem very hard to separate, if you see what I mean. Okay? Clearly spoken language, also quite repetitive in terms of words, in terms of types. Okay? The same tokens are repeated over and over again. Okay? Now compare this to written language. And then, in the blowing clouds, she saw a band of faint iridescence, I guess, coloring in faint colors a portion of the hill. And forgetting, startled, she looked for the hovering color and saw a rainbow forming in itself. In one place it gleamed fiercely, and her heart anguished with hope. She sought the shadow of iris, where the bow should be. Steadily the color gathered. Mysteriously from nowhere it took presence upon itself. There was a faint, vast rainbow. D.H. Lawrence, The Rainbow. So, literature. Fiction. A very, very different register. We have massively different lexical items. We have massively different vocabulary involved. And that's got to do with the different modes of using language, of course. But notice that this is not only about the lexicon. This is not only about the words that are being used. This is also about structure of sentences, about the structure of sentences, about the complexity of sentences, about the way certain, the way the words basically are combined with each other. Okay? And with that, we are going into what we are going to start next week, namely syntax and grammar. You're going to get 4 weeks of syntax from me. Yes? Okay. It's going to be great fun. You're going to get 3 actual lectures from me. And the 4th one is the Christmas present, as you may remember from the schedule. I'm going to upload a lecture which you do not have to listen to on Christmas itself, okay, but which will be finishing the lectures on syntax. Okay. So that's what we're doing and starting next week. Okay. See you next week.
Das ist ein bisschen.